Michael, thanks for coming on to our podcast to get to know the mayoral candidates.
Thank you.
A brief little intro to Michael is he was born actually in Florida and came to Buffalo, which is kind of reverse engineering for a lot of people, it seems. He grew up mostly in Erie and then, similar to me, kind of landed in Buffalo by chance, but has made it his home. He's been here since 2005 and is most known in town for his kind of grassroots activism. Initially founded Buffalo Reuse and now has Reuse Action, starting a school. He's kind of a jack of all trades around town. And what we wanted to do with this podcast is just get to know you a little bit as a person and as a candidate, and then maybe we can get into some of the things that are near and dear to your heart if you're going to be the mayor.
That sounds great. I appreciate it. I appreciate the opportunity.
Certainly. So the first thing I would like to hear is why are you running for mayor? And I don't mean that from the brain reason why you're running to mayor, the policy things that you have, but sort of what's in your heart and your soul that makes you want to do this?
I think that what has driven me here is really just my experience over the last 20 years in someone that has been active in the community, someone that has been working tirelessly to create new initiatives, someone that has gotten to know my neighbors and the work that they're doing very intimately. And it's also someone that just has interacted and engaged with so many people in this community that I believe have really valuable contributions. Like so many people that I encounter that that I know have skills, experience, expertise that would really help to propel the city in amazing ways that just are always left out of the conversation. And, you know, that starts with, you know, my own experience and my own frustrations with city government as I've worked on different initiatives over the last 20 years, whether it be trying to create pocket parks on the east side with money from the Obama administration for neighborhood stabilization, to being denied a letter of support from our own mayor for money that was committed to train and mentor young adults that are out of school and out of work, to just very, very just simple things like trying to beautify a neighborhood, trying to plant sunflowers on Jefferson Avenue in a community that has long been neglected and long been disenfranchised, to have the city again deny our efforts, deny or reject any attempt to cooperate with a vision for just beautifying the Jefferson corridor. And in all of those instances, we found ways to get it done, but it has always been marginal, just kind of playing around the outside. And my vision is really that we can do things, profound things, transformational things in this city that really improve the quality of life, that really provide meaningful investment and job and entrepreneurial opportunities for businesses, that help people to access housing. All of these things can be really leveraged in a positive way with the right leadership. You get that all the time when you talk to people all across town. It's like, Buffalo is its own worst enemy. You know, Buffalo has never had great leadership. Buffalo has, you know, I can't get these things done. I've tried to do these things. How many people have we lost in this city because they just felt like there wasn't a system or a leadership support network to help elevate their ideas? And I just feel like, given the things that I've done, that I have a capacity to do those things. To help to connect the dots, to open the doors for people, to shine the light on inequities and injustices and neglect that most people know about. They've seen it in bursts, but I live it every day. I see it every day in the people that come to my store and the people that live on my street. I'm a really empathetic person. I have a really hard time just turning a blind eye to the realities of my city. And when I know that I have a capacity to make things happen, I feel compelled to act.
I think, part of that points to something that I've felt about Buffalo for a long time. And I've had this theory that there is actually an economy or an economics to decline.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Buffalo entered that several decades ago. And there was all kinds of things that go along with that. You know, demolition is its own economy. Like right. all these things, there's like people are making money when things are declining. And I think what you're speaking to is a mindset that holds on to that mentality of decline. Mm-hmm. And we haven't re-entered, even though there's been a lot of positive change in Buffalo in the last decade, we haven't really, you know, politically, I think, entered the phase where it's like we're building a city again.
Right.
And as opposed to, you know, figuring out how you make money as the city falls apart.
Right.
And there was Absolutely. A lot of that. And I think that part of the relationship that happens between government and people in that situation is that there becomes kind of this feeling that everybody is doing something wrong. Like mm-hmm. everybody's a bad landlord, everybody's this or whatever. And it erodes trust. So what you're saying speaks to something even larger than just doing things. So how would you really attack that and change the mentality of the city?
Yeah. Well, here's what I know. When I came here back in 2005 and I proposed this idea of Buffalo reuse, the place for community news at the time was Buffalo Rising, right? And you went on there and you could read from the comments, you know, the sentiment of the people, which is exactly what you're saying. Oh, people have tried that before. That will never happen. Things will never change in Buffalo. It's always going to be this way, blah, blah, blah. So, you know, as an outsider, like I don't buy into that narrative. As an outsider, I'm someone that just believes in my own capacity. I believe in the power of ideas. I believe in of the power of people when they come together to do things. And, you know, what communicated that it could be different is by starting, by actually just initiating the idea. I understand why that mentality is pervasive here. You know, it is a reality that we've lost an enormous amount of population over the last 70 years. And that's exactly why an outsider is best suited for this position now, because I'm not held hostage by our history or our past. I only see the potential. And yes, I've had frustrations, and yes, I've had, you know, opportunities and points where I was like, I just want to leave this place and I need a break. I bought a house in Niagara Falls and took off for a year and a half and rehabbed that, and I just needed a break. But I get reinvigorated and, you know, I get committed again to the cause because of, you know, the potential that I see here, which, you know, I've lived all over. I've lived on the West Coast, in Portland and Eugene, on the East Coast, in Portland and Boston and New York City. And I've seen cities, but what this city offers for communities and for business is just really unique. So you just need to start and show people, and you can have a big, massive vision. You know, that's, I talk a lot about vision in my campaign. Like, you have to have a place that you're directing the ship and the place that you're trying to move towards. But the meaning is really in just the small efforts every day that communicate to regular people that things can be different. And I did that through my own campaign, just petitioning, just speaking with people, just having an authentic interaction. People would say, I've been in Buffalo for 50 years. I've never met a mayoral candidate on the bus or on the train or even out petitioning for themselves. And that got me thinking. I was like, well, how many candidates actually petition for themselves? So now I'm going back through petitions and the majority don't. I think that the only person that I've actually validated has collected their own signatures, and it is Anthony Tyson Thompson, you know? So it's like those types of things demonstrate to people that you're a different kind of person, that you are invested at the grassroots, that you are invested in their everyday lives, that you are invested in the power of ideas, and that you are committed to doing the work necessary to help right the ship.
So I agree with, you know, having a vision that you're going toward, but then what would be the first thing that you would do if you become mayor that is like a concrete thing that is setting the groundwork to get to that place?
Well, the first thing is, you know, a comprehensive, you know, staffing audit of who is at City Hall. What are the goals and objectives of every city department? What are their short-term objectives, long-term objectives? What's their current staffing, you know, requirements? What is their current budget? And then we can start to figure out what we're working with at City Hall. The second part is then assembling the team, because I have a lot of ideas, you know, but I know that there are a lot of experts in each field, in finance, in housing, right, in law enforcement, in public safety, in emergency services, maybe people that are candidates right now, right, that could be brought to the table as part of our administration. So the big part is putting together an effective team that can help to implement some of the long-term goals that we have. But it has to start with a short-term analysis to figure out what's currently being done. I'm not the type, I've been an employer and a boss for 22 years. And the people that know me know that I'm not the type to just walk into an office and pull the rug out from under someone. I have a lot of respect for the people that have committed their lives to public service, that are in these jobs and in these fields and have been for many, many years. That being said, I've also been on the outside witnessing what I believe to be an overall deterioration of the culture at City Hall and just how people feel about their jobs, not just the job that they're doing, but like their level of investment to that job. I don't know how many people I've talked that are counting down the years to retirement or when they can get an early retirement. And it just shouldn't be that way. Like, I want our employees and our staff and our team and our public servants and even our elected officials to feel inspired to do their work and engaged with a vision that really contributes to healthier communities, a more vibrant city, a growing population, something where the eyes of the world are on Buffalo saying something really special is happening here. Because I see it every day. Newell sees it every day. You see it probably every day. This the special pockets and the creative energy that's happening. And I can't help but think of the potential when we mobilize that in a productive and inspiring and focused, directed way. How powerful that can be to people that are considering moving here. You know, I met three people during petitioning at Nietzsche's that had just moved to Buffalo this week. And I remember during the Buffalo Reuse days, many people that would come through as travelers and they would experience Buffalo and then they would stay. And a year or two later, they'd be buying a house. And a year or two later, they're contributing to creating, you know, an organization or doing urban farming or doing whatever. Like, that's the type of spirit that when you catch it, you don't want to let it go, you know? And I still see it in some pockets. I don't feel like it has the same fervor, right, that it had when I was here in 2010, 2012, even 2014 a little bit. But I do know that it's there and that when we all start speaking in a similar language and with a similar focus, I feel like it's going to attract more people. And, you know, I was inspired by, you know, just the vision of Buffalo Rising, right? To highlight people's stories, to highlight different initiatives. And now if you have a city that's speaking that language, you know, as a chorus, like, I think it can be very powerful. And I talk a lot about this in terms of vision, is bringing more tourists to the city and the economic impact to our local businesses and our downtown businesses. You know, Joe at the Inn Buffalo, right? He speaks very eloquently about this, like, add Niagara Falls to the Visit Buffalo Niagara, because by Niagara Falls is the attractor, right? Everybody, people come from all over the world to Niagara Falls. If we could capture half of the U.S. tourists, right, that would be $1.5 billion to $2 billion a year in local investment into our hotels, into our Airbnbs, into our restaurants, how transformative that could be. And then you get all those people here saying, wow, this place is really amazing. I'd relocate my business here. Right. And then you have a larger megaphone where you are actively trying to attract businesses here and entrepreneurs and creative types because of the quality of the community, because of the assets that downtown has to offer. So that's what That's the power of messaging and the power of vision. It inspires people to be here and contribute, invest, and build, you know? And that's what gets me excited.
Well, one of the things I agree with you on some things there. One of them is that I agree that I think these smaller projects mm-hmm. that happen around the city, and there's lots and lots of them, mm-hmm. many of them that, you know, I don't know about, you know, there's so many things going on that we don't know all about them. You know, we hear about the big things,
right.
that where there's a ribbon cutting or a huge new project or something like that. But that's true that these things that are happening in communities that are, somebody's opening a small business and somebody's doing this over here and that mm-hmm. over there. Those are the things that really help tie the city together.
Right.
And create community. And one of the things that Buffalo offers over many other cities is there is the opportunity to do those things here. And
right.
the time that you came here in the early 2000s, 2010, the city was certainly more depressed, so it was easier to do it back then.
Mm-hmm.
But this is still a remarkable place to be, to come and open a business and do something, have an idea. It's mm-hmm. It's still an affordable place to be. And so that is certainly one of its assets.
Absolutely.
One of the things that to divert a little bit about, and I have my own thoughts and feelings that I will follow up with you about in sort of a follow-up questioning, but you know, the 33 mm-hmm. is a big issue. There has been a series of big, I would say, transportation infrastructure issues that have come through Buffalo over the past couple of decades. But right now we're focused on the 33. So
sure.
Be interested in your comments on that.
Sure. So for me, you know, a lot of the conversation with 33 Expressway, its focus is on neighborhood health. And it should. I mean, for certain, you know, urban highways are not supportive of healthy communities, period. Like, they're just not. They were built at a time to, you know, when the city was, the country had this, you know, very car-centric philosophy. There was suburban areas were sprawling. People were rejecting downtown urban centers, and those highways paved the way for that expansion. And we know what happened. It came at the detriment of healthy urban centers and healthy urban communities. So yes, the health of the neighborhood is very, very important to me. And obviously one of the things that, you know, when I spoke to members of ROC before I got involved in Eastside Parkways, you know, that was what they led with. You know, Stephanie Barber Jeter clearly said to me when I spoke to her just a few months before she passed, like, that highway is killing people. The highway is killing people. And when I would appeal to her about, but Stephanie, the highway still is there, her retort was always just, the highway is killing people. So for me, that communicated what my mandate was to be. It wasn't now about sabotaging another community organization's effort. It was about addressing what was their founding principle, which is they want a highway removed that's killing their community. And that's very much how they, at the very, very beginning of this conversation, that's how this conversation began. Now, the DOT intervened, the business community intervened, and they got ROC to settle on a lesser plan that delivered some of the benefits without really addressing the root cause of their concern, which is the highway is killing people. So the health effects aside, I think about it from 30,000 feet. As the mayor of Buffalo, I can't be distracted by, all right, and we'll go back to, you know, what we were talking about in terms of, you know, people and their lack of vision and their you know, always looking at these kind of short-term fixes, right? I can't be distracted by short-term fixes. Politicians cling onto ribbon cuttings and short-term fixes because it helps them get to the next step in their political career, the next re-election, the next the next higher office, whatever it happens to be, the next appointment or promotion or whatever it happens to be in the public or private sector. But we, if we're serving the region, it's not about me. I say this in my campaign cover. It's about us. It's about not me. It's about we. And you have to think about this issue from 30,000 feet. We're a state with limited resources. We are a city with limited resources, which means we have to be very conscientious. We have to be very thoughtful about every investment of every dollar. We had huge missed opportunities with COVID relief funds where we could have invested $330 million into communities or into education or into training infrastructure that would have sustained us. Now we're looking at $1.5 billion plus dollars in committed revenue from the state, money that will be spent, whether it be on a tunnel or on maintaining the infrastructure as it is currently, rebuilding the retaining walls and rebuilding the bridges. Or hopefully the better option is to invest that money strategically into our commercial corridors, into the best designed city in the world. Right? Into a radial street design that was intentionally created to move people efficiently from outlying areas to the downtown so that we get a long-term economic benefit from a finite expenditure of tax dollars today. Right? Money that we expend on Genesee Street to rebuild its street infrastructure, to redo its lighting, to add a bike lane, to plan for light rail transportation that we could install 50 years from now. That investment today or in the next 5 years will pay dividends for the next 50 to 100 years because now we are supporting local business on those commercial streets. We're supporting housing investment on those commercial streets. We're building a market for customers and businesses that establish along the Genesee Corridor. And people will be like, oh, it's going to take me longer. It's going to take, it may take you a minute or two longer. I'm okay with that because I know that when there are people in their cars on Niagara Street taking a minute too longer or on Elmwood Avenue taking a minute or two longer, they don't complain. Because they can also stop at the grocery store. They can stop at the flower shop and pick up on their way home some flowers for their sweetheart. They can stop for a coffee in the morning or a breakfast sandwich on their way into work. It's a more enjoyable experience. And, you know, it's just a better overall ecosystem for transportation and local economic investment in the city. And I think that's what we need to think about is, what does our city look like after this project is complete? You know, what does a fully restored parkway, a filled in, you know, 33 expressway actually do to transform the Frederick Law Olmsted Park system into a landscape treasure that can attract tourism? What will it do for the quality of life around those neighborhoods? What will it do for Golden Cup and, you know, Sunshine Vegan Eats to have a more robust customer base on those streets? It will be transformative. I am not looking at a $1 billion shot in the arm. I'm looking at $500 billion over the next 20 years in long-term economic investment. People are going to be like, those numbers aren't real. Okay, well then let's just look at a microcosm of that. The east end of the inner loop, right? A very small section of pretty much underutilized, unused highway. Attracted $200 million in private investment in 3 years.
You're speaking about Rochester?
Yes, in Rochester. So successful that now they've expanded that project to the North End inner loop removal, which is a project that is not the same in any way, nor am I comparing it, but I am comparing how when you remove an urban highway, you open up the door for economic investment into the central urban core of those communities. You reconnect the street grid, you reinvigorate the communities, and you breathe new life into the commercial community that did not exist there before. And that is really, from 30,000 feet, my long-term vision for the east side of Buffalo, because right now that highway is a physical barrier that divides the city. It's a physical barrier that maintains a segregationist, racist history that got us, you know, to where we're at today. And it is a physical barrier that will maintain that history until it's removed.
Well, I would agree with that and maybe push it one step farther. From being in Buffalo a long time, you know, there was the Peace Bridge. There mm-hmm. was the, you know, there was the, you know, the thing about the Cuomo did a design competition for the Skyway. The 198 has come up. And all of these projects are little silos that, to me, it's one project.
Right. Right.
We need to look at the entire transportation
for sure.
infrastructure of the city.
Yeah.
And so I think that focusing on these single projects, again, like you're saying, it's like it's a ribbon cutting. It's one little thing. It's something right. that can happen, let's say, in my tenure.
For sure.
As opposed to like looking at the whole city and the way the whole city works. And I think that's the way we need to do it. A couple examples that come to my mind in my travels is, you know, San Francisco was fortunate that, you know, the 1989 earthquake collapsed the Embarcadero, which was their 190, which mm-hmm. which was a elevated highway that blocked San Francisco from being on the water anymore.
Right.
So now that's a parkway. But, you know, I travel to Nashville fairly often. That's where my in-laws are. And, you know, that's a booming city. You can certainly have some criticisms about it. But and then when my wife worked in Scottsdale, you know, you go there and I would see these massive, you know, 8-lane roads. And it was just like it was a nightmare to me.
Right.
But driving around in both these cities now, what you notice is the traffic engineering is just really good.
Yeah.
And you can get through Nashville because at a certain time of day, you go to like flashing amber lights. I mean, I just think of driving up Main Street in mm-hmm. Buffalo, and it's just like you're there at 11 o'clock at night, and it's just red light after red light after yeah. red light, and you're the only one there.
Right, right.
And so that's why I think all of this stuff is, it's one plan. It's like, if you're going to take away the 33, like, what do we do with red lights?
Right.
What do we do? Like, all of these things need to be thought about.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I wonder if we even have in Buffalo, honestly, the brain power to do that. Like, mm-hmm. I am sure these places are bringing in, like, world-class experts to right. figure this stuff out.
But that's, but here's the thing, is that that's where we need to be spending our money. Because if we think about it in the exact same way that you're saying, which is the way that we should be thinking about it, like, they immediately... Right, separated Skajakwita Corridor from the Humboldt, you know, from the 33. They're intimately connected highways. Like you can't transform one without transforming them both. So, you know, and then, you know, what impact does that have on the 190? You know, it is a whole ecosystem, and you're exactly right. So, you know, but that is where I would much prefer us to be spending $50 to $100 million. You know, the fill-in option doesn't require the massive investment of physical infrastructure that's going to take a lot of money. We're going to basically transform that into an at-grade transportation network, which is a much cheaper modification. To be looking at-grade streets now and trying to figure out, okay, how do we improve? Because this came up in one of our ESP meetings, is that the DOT has hung their hat onto maintaining vehicular capacity, right? Well, why can we not just say we intend to maintain vehicular capacity, but we're going to do it in a different way? We're going to do it by adding a new exit off of the 90 to get onto Broadway. We're going to do it by adding roundabouts at the now 33 Expressway and Harlem to get people more efficiently onto Genesee Street. We're going to look at the whole organism as a system, and we're going to design it well, and we're going to, you know, think about the long term. Because the other thought that comes up, and it's a justifiable concern, is yes, the street grid can handle the traffic today, but what do we do in 50 years or 100 years? Well, yes. And that's exactly why we don't have the capacity or the financial capability today to build light rail in all 6 or 8 of those directions along those radial grids. But we should plan for it today so that it's just a matter of leveraging additional tax dollars if and when the city increases, which I am confident the city is going to increase. We're a climate resilient city. We have amazing resources here. And with the right leadership, I know it's going to grow, and it's going to grow fast. And the great, the bigger concern is going to be how we manage to protect people that have lived here their whole lives, legacy residents, legacy businesses, protect them and so that they are incorporated and not pushed out of our city. And I think that'll be a nice different way to think about how to solve problems. Because with good leadership, I'm confident that the city will take off and it will grow exponentially over the next 15 to 20 years. And we're going to have to maybe be revisiting a transportation grid in 10 to 15 years to think about now how we take it to the next step. And I welcome that opportunity.
Well, you started to get into one other, you know, critical major issue that's being discussed right now. Well, it's been discussed as long as I've been in Buffalo, and that is the fiscal state of the city. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things, you know, obviously that is, you know, I guess happening or, you know, now is selling the parking garages. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that seems to happen, not just in Buffalo, but everywhere when there's some kind of, you know, need for money within a government is fees go up, fines go up. Mm-hmm. Like there's this, you know, this whole other infrastructure of collecting money that kind of kicks into high gear. But it is a reality that we have some financial issues in the city, mm-hmm, of Buffalo. And so I guess one is, how do you feel about what is being done right now? And then what are some things that you would be looking at that might be different or maybe aligned with what's happening?
Right. Well, I think that selling the parking ramp, selling any public asset is short-term thinking, in my opinion. Anything that has the potential to generate long-term revenue that's managed by the city. Yes, it's work to maintain it, but you know, we maintain buildings and infrastructure all over the city. That's low hanging fruit to maintain parking garages when you're looking at a potential of $5 to $6 million in annual revenue generated from those institutions. So it is only a short-term fix. And I think that everybody has said that quite eloquently. I think that the big picture is really about all of the other things that we've mentioned in parts, looking at the current ecosystem of City Hall and how we've spent money, but looking at how we do multiple things with the funding that we have. I think that just like you talk when you brought up the transportation and we think about things as isolated projects, we don't think about it as an organism. City Hall very much functions in the same way, in silos that are separated from other departments where there's very little cross district or cross departmental communication. And I think it's really at the loss of our communities that we don't have more collaboration between, for example. I have an initiative that I talk about all the time because we talk about public safety and we think, okay, it's easy. We just put more cops on the street. Or, you know, or we talk about education. Oh, it's great. We just put more money into community centers. Or we talk about public works having to spend all this money on vacant lots. Why are we not looking at the city as an organism and figuring out that a big part of our policing issue has to do with people that are creating nightmares in our neighborhoods because they have nothing to do or may not have skills and experience or may not have a job opportunity. You know, I actually was speaking to a friend and he said, you know, if I wanted to solve crime tomorrow, the one thing that I would do is make sure everybody has a job. Because if everybody has access to an employment opportunity or a training opportunity or an opportunity to have purposeful work in their lives, then there's not people running around hustling drugs, stealing Hyundais, doing whatever it is that's creating chaos in our neighborhoods that right now is very much connected to the social health of our city, or the social unhealth of our city. So the initiative is City Action Corps, which was a program that I should have started back in 2009, had our mayor signed a letter of support for it. And then it would be a thriving ecosystem that would be transforming neighborhoods today. And that is to take our young adults that are out of school or underemployed and leverage them to do work directly in our neighborhoods. So through a unique collaboration between community works and community programming and public works, we would have young people, crews of young people all over the city, improving our commercial districts and improving our residential streets, planting tens of thousands of trees, improving vacant lots, you know, helping elderly folks, legacy residents maintain their homes. Basic, high labor, low skill, purposeful work in the neighborhood that also addresses the social and educational needs of our neighborhoods. That's how you think about an organism. That's how we think about spending our resources more wisely so that we're getting the greatest the greatest bang from our investment of tax dollars. And then the other thing is we have to grow the city. And when we grow the city, we increase the tax base. But then finally, we need to make sure that it's equitable and fair. And currently, you know, in the 2019 assessment that went through, it created a situation that is less equal and less fair than it's been in previous years. It shifted the burden of taxation from our wealthiest, most stable neighborhoods, all right, that have long benefited from, fair valuation of their property, to West Side and East Side neighborhoods that just happened to win the valuation lottery over the last 20 years, where we've seen 400% increases in the value of those properties. And consequently, now they're shouldering a disproportionate burden of the tax levy. And I think that we have to figure out ways to create a more equitable tax system that brings more consistent, reliable revenue to the city. And then we have to think about how we're using it in a creative way to meet the many needs of our city while we're growing the population and bringing more tourists here that can invest, build, and work.
You bring up a lot of good points there. And one of the things I hope to do with this podcast series is to have everybody on, hopefully several times before the actual election, and get into some of these issues more. I have a lot of my own thoughts about the taxation and things like that. I think that is a whole podcast to itself.
It sure is.
And
a lot to unpack there.
Yeah. It's something I am personally truly passionate about. So I look forward to talking to all the candidates about that. Mm-hmm. The last thing I'd like to ask you is, you know, one of the things I think Buffalo doesn't do a great job of is looking at other places' success stories and
for sure.
And learning, one of the benefits of being a little bit behind the eight ball is other people have done it.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them have tried it. It didn't work. Some of it's worked, and you can learn from those other examples. So if you could pick one other city or one other leader, let's say not at the national level, but at a local level, that's a place, a city, whether it's a person or a city, whatever, that, you think has done a good job or you would, like, look to as a place to aspire to, what would that be?
Oh, boy. That's a really hard question because I look to so... I wish there was in this country a good visionary model that I really loved. But, you know, and I haven't, to be honest, found that. But I have found these pockets of inspiration when I visited other Rust Belt cities, to be honest. Because I tend to draw the greatest inspiration from cities that have a lot of our same struggles, right? That saw dramatic decreases in their population, that saw dramatic decreases in divestment and manufacturing, that have these large city infrastructures that are far beyond, you know, what they really can feasibly manage and maintain with their tax infrastructure. And, you know, Detroit, even though their leadership continues to disappoint, what is inspiring to me is the sheer will and drive of the people there. Their whole community agricultural program that has been thriving for years, where they've transformed in spite of the city and in spite of any cooperation from local leadership to get people involved in local growing, to start businesses, to maintain a level of subsistence farming and agriculture, to revitalize and breathe new life into what were vacant lots and now are vibrant community spaces. Like, I visited that city on my bicycle in 2012, and everywhere you go, you know, there are pockets of creativity and entrepreneurship and art and food production and people just doing it, just everywhere you go. You don't have to even create a map. It was like when I visited Germany and I was looking for adventure playgrounds, right? Because I was all inspired about this free play, open play. And I had a beeline for this adventure playground that I found on a map. And I went there and I was totally inspired by the elements and the loose parts and the creativity of the kids. And then I biked back to my hostel and I passed by 6 or 7 other adventure playgrounds. Like, you don't need to look for it. It's just there. And I think that's a metaphor for Buffalo, right? Is that in spite of everything that's happened here and the neglect and the incompetent leadership and the disconnected and misguided leadership that we have here, there are these pockets of inspiration everywhere. Little community homeschool efforts and art projects and speakeasies in the back of garages and, you know, just this energy and this will to create and be purposeful and support your community. And I think that gives me inspiration every day here, but I'm always looking out and trying to bring elements and best practices back here to inspire our next effort.
Michael, thanks for coming on, and I look forward to our next conversation.
I appreciate it. Thanks, Jam.